That needed healing so badly. This is a violent story, and it comes from a violent book called the Bible. If you don't like violence, you don't read this book. But it is violent because it's realistic. It works in the mode of realism. It's not fantasy, it's not a fairy story, it's not a romance, it's realistic. And for better or for worse, often worse, it reports to us how life really is. And so this is a dark story of Herod's anger and his insecurity and really his madness in his decision to kill all of the boys in the region of Bethlehem 2 years and younger. Now, the gospel begins with a warning given to Joseph in a dream. An angel tells him, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. And so they leave by night. They become fugitives in their own country, and they have to become refugees into another country, which is Egypt. And they stay there for an undetermined time. The gospel doesn't tell us this. But they go to Egypt, which becomes a place of safety for them. Now, you can't read this gospel without thinking about Old Testament stories involving Egypt with the people of God in the Old Testament. Joseph, dreams, all those kinds of things really resonate when you think about the story of Jacob and his 12 sons. His 11th son, his name was Joseph, he was sold into slavery in Egypt, as you probably know. And he ended up living there and becoming second only to Pharaoh in that country. And because of the providence of God, the people of Israel were preserved from famine. And they were able to flourish. And they lived in Egypt for 400 plus years, long after Joseph had died. But there was another threat of danger put out by a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph and didn't like the Jews. So about 1,300 years before this gospel this morning, the bad guy was a Pharaoh in Egypt who was also insecure, who was also angry, who was threatened by the Jews because they were flourishing. They were becoming really populous. And he didn't want them to side with their enemies. So you know what Pharaoh did? He called up the Hebrew midwives to himself. And he gave them a commandment. He said, I want you, when you're at the birth school, if a girl is born, let her live. But if a boy is born, I want you to kill him. That's the Pharaoh. You don't say no to Pharaoh, at least to his face. So what did they do? They went off. And they decided that they wouldn't do what he commanded. Because the text in Exodus tells us they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. And so Hebrew boys were born, and probably among them was Moses. Pharaoh eventually gets word that it's not working out like he commanded, so he calls them back to himself. And he says, what's happening? Explain yourselves. And then the two Hebrew midwives, their names are Shifra and Pua, they were given names in the text, very significant. And they said to the Pharaoh, they said, well, you know, the Hebrew women aren't like the Egyptians. They're so vigorous, they give birth before we can get there. So they outsmarted him. They outsmarted the violence of Pharaoh. They outwitted his attempt to destroy the people of God. And it said, the text tells them that God rewarded them for their faithfulness and gave them families of their own. And because of their civil disobedience, this is probably the first ever recorded act of civil disobedience, because what they did was illegal. Because of that, we remember them and we know their names. And we also know that a child, Moses, was born and eventually will grow to lead his people out of the bondage of Egypt through the wilderness towards the promised land. Moses, who is described in the book of Numbers as the meekest man that lived, the humblest man of all, at least at that time, so much so that God could speak to him mouth to mouth. He said, he's not just a prophet, he's something much more. So in his humility, Moses was able to do a great work. But he was preserved from that shadow of death by the midwives. So let's go back to the gospel. We have another threat of death, and we have another hero whose life could have been snuffed out if it hadn't been for the angelic intervention. Some of the fathers say this is an ironic story because Christ is actually, as an infant, nourishing his own mother and guiding his own father. out of the danger of that country. And so he is spared. But unfortunately, the boys who were left behind in Bethlehem were not. And that's a terrible thing. The unconsolable grief of the mothers is almost impossible to relate to because it's so heinous, it's so savage. You know, the gospel doesn't tell us how many boys were killed, how many infant boys lost their lives. In the Byzantine tradition, it's 14,000. 14,000 holy innocents, they're called. In the Syriac Orthodox tradition, it's in the 60,000 range. Scholars who study this time historically think both of those estimates are a little too high based on what the population of that area would have been around Bethlehem. But you know, even if it was only 10 children or only one child, it would have been one too many. It would have been cold-blooded murder. Absolutely dark. And the very thing that the Lord came to help us overcome in the fallenness of our world. So this morning, as we look at this text, I just want to try to make 3 points. The first one is about the origin of violence, the source of violence. And then the second will be how the Lord himself responded to violence in his life. Like, how did he teach us to react to violence? And then finally, what about us? Because we live in an awful violent world. How do we relate to that? First thing about violence is that the church fathers say it comes from a source within ourselves. So we don't blame God for bad things that happen because the violence comes from human beings who make bad choices that have passions, right? So the illness of our soul means that the powers of our soul are being badly misdirected away from their proper, you know, source. We're using our anger in the wrong way. We're using our mind in the wrong way. We're using our appetites in the wrong way. And that's why we start to harm people. So it's our passions that end up leading to the kind of behavior that ends up like what Herod's doing. Think about Herod. He was threatened, right? He was insecure. You know, he had been king for almost 40 years by the time he was through with his reign. He was appointed the king of Judea by the Roman Senate, 40 B.C., believe it or not. And he reigned something like 37 years. So he'd been king a long time. And he was getting old, and he had a lot of illnesses. And he was also kind of becoming more violent as time went on. He had 3 of his own sons killed because he felt that they might be threatening his power. He had many wives. His favorite wife, she was killed as well. And he would walk around at night calling her name and demanding that she be brought to him after he killed her. And he would beat his servants who couldn't bring her to him. So he was really losing it. You know, just days before he finally died, historians tell us that he rounded up thousands of notables all over Judea and ordered his troops to gather them and take them to a stadium in Jericho. And when he died, the order was to kill all those people. To go out with mourning. Because he wanted mourning in the land of Israel. He knew that if he died, no one would mourn for him.
Yeah.
It's so twisted. And thank God that plan was not accomplished. But Herod was a bad actor. But his passions had absolutely overcome him. So what's the difference now today between the day of Herod the Great or between our times and the time of Pharaoh who wanted to kill all of the Hebrew boys? Is there any fundamental difference? Well, Metropolitan Tikhon made a really beautiful statement last January, I think it was on the Sanctity of Life Sunday. And he said, you know, really the conditions of the human heart are pretty much what they were in ancient times. But what's different now is the scale at which we can inflict violence. The amount of violence that we can do. We can type in a few characters and destroy a whole city across the globe. We can wipe out 100,000 people with a single bomb. And, you know, since 1973, we have killed 60 million unborn innocents in our country alone. So that's the scale of violence that we still live with. So the source of violence then is our own passions. And the problem is we tend to see ourselves as the center of reality. And other people become subjects in our narrative. And we use people as props to create the kind of story for our own lives and accomplish the things that we want to do. See, those children were going to be a block to Herod's plan for his reign in Judea. They might get in the way of his narrative as being the great king. And so they were expendable. They became objects. They weren't people anymore. So in our brokenness, this is a terrible thing that we, I think, all suffer, is we tend to think of ourselves as more important than other people. But that's not the way it is. Everybody is important. All creatures have equal standing before the court. But it's weird as a human being, because our consciousness means that we, like, are the center of our consciousness, right? So we're kind of the subject to which everybody else is sort of an object. And it takes a lot, I think, of divine grace to help us over time to start seeing people as being equal to ourselves. And violence is often perpetrated by people who are so overcome by greed and madness and insecurity and anger, and you go down the list, our passions that really override our ability to see other people as being made in the image of God and being equal to ourselves. So the problem of violence is still a problem. How about the Lord now? Same point. How did he respond to violence? Give me a couple examples now. Once when he was traveling back with his disciples towards Jerusalem, they went through a Samaritan village. Remember the story? And James and John were upset because the Samaritans did not offer them hospitality, which is not just a minor thing. It's sort of a cultural expectation that he would be offered hospitality. So you know what James and John did? They said to the Lord, hey, should we call down fire from heaven and just destroy them? Should we do that? Wow. So the Lord rebukes them, and he says, you do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. See, they wanted to wipe them out. They might have been inspired by a spirit to say that, but it wasn't the Spirit of God. We have really good proof of that from his response. How about when the Lord was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane? Judas comes up, gives him the kiss as the signal to the soldiers. They come to arrest him. And Peter, in his sort of impetuosity, pulls out his sword. Off goes the slave's right ear. What does the Lord do? Say, thanks, Peter. Good shot. Way to go. He doesn't say that. He says, put up your sword. He says, those who take up the sword are going to die by the sword. That's what he told them. He didn't want a violent, physical, rescue in that moment. Even said in one account of the gospel, said, don't you know I could appeal to my Father right now and I can get 12 legions of angels to fight for me? That's 72,000. He could just call them in and blow the soldiers away. He didn't do it. That's not how he dealt with violence. Alright. We get a clue to how he's going to end his life on earth from his Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount has got to be one of the most radical things ever written and heard by human ears. Because the Lord is taking the spiritual life to the highest imaginable degree of perfection. How about anger? He says in the sermon in Matthew 5, he says, you've heard that it was said to men of old, you shall not kill. But I say to you that everyone who's angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, shall be liable to the hell of fire. Yeah. Wow. That's a high bar. See, what he's into is not just avoiding physical violence, but he doesn't commit spiritual violence. He doesn't hate back. He doesn't want revenge. See, he's got a secret. See, there's like a spiritual law at play that really doesn't make sense to us in a worldly sense, which is how to deal with the problem of evil. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist one who is evil. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. If anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. See, this is an absolutely upside down way of thinking about reality from what we kind of learn in the world. Said, you heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This is how violence is dealt with. And this is how he did it. If anybody ever practiced what he preached, it was him. And so when he's being crucified, when people are spitting on him and mocking him and every other manner of insult, he never gives in and retaliates right back. We talked, I think, a month or two ago about how good teachers often don't answer a question of somebody because they want to take them to a higher level. Because if you answer a question on the level that it's asked, it consolidates that question at the mental level at which it was asked. And holding back on an answer helps people to go higher and find deeper insight. You know, if you answer violence back on the level of violence, you're just consolidating that person on the level of violence, as well as bringing difficulties to your own soul. So the Lord would never do that, because he actually wanted to save all men and not destroy them. Even the people that were destroying him, he wanted to save, so he would never stoop to the level of violence. There's a story in the Desert Fathers that has always struck me, and it was of a holy monk who had a reputation for prayer. And there were parents nearby in Egypt who had a daughter who was demon-possessed. And they wanted to go seek the prayers of this holy monk. So they went to his cell, and they knocked on the door. He opened the door, and before anyone could say anything, the demon-possessed girl just reached out and struck him in the head and the face. And you know what happened? He turned his cheek. And at that moment, there was a shriek, and the demons fled from that girl, because he couldn't stand to be in the presence of such humility and such purity of heart. See, that's how evil is dispatched. It's so beautiful. And his disciples, the monk who were there, they said, this is how the pride of the devil is brought lower, through the humility of the commandments of Christ. So we can see in how he lived his life, we have kind of a key to how to deal with the problem of evil. And we see it in the lives of martyrs all the time, refusing to defend themselves or fight back with physical force. Look at Jesus' own death. That's the ultimate example. He's the archetype of how to deal with evil. Because he dealt with evil in his way, we all have hope now for a better day and a better death and a better life. So what did he do? He didn't defend himself. In his purity, in his perfection, in his sinlessness, he dies on our behalf. And this is a great mystery. It's called the atonement. And if you look up the atonement and try to study it, it really is hard to get your mind around, because if you can't get your mind around it, and to read what people write about it can be really difficult. It reminds me of the saying that Garrison Keillor once had. He said, intelligence is like four-wheel drive. It just enables you to get stuck in more remote places. And so when you're really trying to understand what happened there, it's awful hard to get. For me, what works a little better is something a little more simple. Like even in C.S. Lewis's The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, we have this amazing death and resurrection of the great lion. And he's explaining after the terrifically saddened and despondent children realize that he somehow come back to life after he was killed by this witch. And he says to them, you know, there's a deeper magic from before time than you knew about. And he explains it like this: when a willing victim who committed no treachery is killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. And I think that's a pretty beautiful way of trying to explain the mystery of what the Lord's death did. Death starts working backwards. Christ is risen from the dead, trampling down death by death. He had to die an unjust death to somehow defeat the power of death. You know, some of the fathers talk about this idea that as human beings, before the Lord's death and resurrection, we had been held hostage by sin and death and the devil. He had us. There was really no way out of that. Yeah? And so what happens? Well, he dies. And the devil thinks that he's now gained the victory over the Lord. So he decides to take him down to Hades and lock him up. That'll show him. Sort of like, I'm gonna put a supernova in my basement. And just no one will know that it's there. There's so much power, there's so much energy, there's so much life, that he breaks down the bars and gates of Hades. And he opens up the way for us through the doorway of death into life for our souls. So that's how he responded to violence: with humility, with purity of heart, and a willingness to sacrifice oneself in love. And that's how you deal with violence, because we don't respond on the same level, because you're stuck there now too. You never got stuck there. All right, finally, what about our response? How do we live in an often violent world? Well, we've got to do what the midwives did, and we've got to do what the Lord did, which is like to outwit the violent people. We've got to outsmart the darkness that does want to envelop us. How do we do that? Well, we can't do it on our own. Because if we have to go one-on-one with the powers of darkness, we're lost. We can't do that. But we know that the Lord has already been victorious. So what we need to do is what St. Paul said in Ephesians 6, which is put on the armor of God. He writes, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. So this is the thing. This is the kind of the paradox, is that the Lord calls us to be peacemakers, but we're also in the midst of a spiritual battle. So we have to be kind of peaceful warriors. We have to be nonviolent soldiers, because we are fighting war. If we don't know that we're in the midst of a spiritual warfare, then we're already losing. Because we've got to get in touch with that, because there are forces of darkness that want to derail us, and they want to lead us into a bad place. Okay, so this is what St. Paul says. We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. It wasn't really Herod that was the enemy there. It was the spiritual force of darkness that was animating that poor man in his desperate insecurity. So Paul continues, "Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take the helmet of salvation." And finally, the only offensive weapon here, the sword of the Spirit. See, God's doing most of this for us. And thank God, because he has the power to do so. Right? And then he finally says, praying always with prayer and supplication in the Spirit. You know, there's a curious passage in Matthew where the Lord is talking about St. John the Baptist. He says, "Since the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of God suffers violence, and the violent take it by force." It's kind of an odd passage, and the Father's, you know, puzzled about that, different ways of interpreting it. But one of the favorite patristic ways of seeing that is that in order to achieve the kingdom, we need, in a certain sense, to exercise violence. And not in the way of physical violence against other people, but violence against our own lesser selves, violence against our own bad habits, violence against our own laziness, violence against all the things that are keeping us from growing deeper in the light and love of Christ. So we have to do violence in a strange way. It's been said that we need to work out an ongoing sacrifice of small deaths to oneself for the sake of others. That's a great goal. It's hard, but a good goal. Achieve humility by ongoing sacrifice and small deaths to oneself. So maybe that's the Byron who take it by force. But it's not by physical force, because we know the Lord didn't endorse that. So we need to follow St. Paul's model in Ephesians. We need to be dressed up in truth. We need to be truthful, faithful, peaceful, prayerful, and depend on God's help. So if we have God in our hearts and our lives, the more we get of him, the more he increases, the more that we decrease, the more we can walk into the darkness of this world and not be overcome by it. Because we know that the light came into the world, and light is life, and life is the light of man. And it came in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. So we don't have to fear anything, but we have to make sure that we're connected with that source of light. So wherever we go in this dark world, we'll be soldiers of peace, and we'll carry the light of God into the darkness with us. So may God help us to do that. Amen. Father,